This is 2 of 7, Part A of a Child Guidance Series by Frank Phillips. Feel free to copy and share with others.
If we were building our counsel, our guidance, on the basis of the chart that we have listed here, justice mingled with mercy constitute actually God's plan for parents, and the net result of this is love. Now, there are many sources of information that are available to you on this subject, but I suppose that there's no finer material that I know of that is in a condensed form than is found in this little book, The Life of Victory by Meade McGuire. Now, if you haven't obtained this book yet, now this book is $3 and it's a little gem, and if this were the last one in the country, I would suggest that it's worth $30. We got these, as you know how. We hunted all over. This is long out of print, but this was printed by the Hudson Press over in Eastern Oregon and printed about 10 years ago. And actually been laying on the shelves there. They never did really advertise them, and they had still had 150 of them left, and we bought all of them. Now, if you're interested in this little book, this is what we're using in our Wednesday night meetings, not just it alone, but this is covers the message. But in here, there's a section that deals with the matter of justice and mercy. How can God justify a sinner? Now, this is in reality the kernel of the thing that we're talking about here, and I would suggest very definitely that you get one of these. My wife has a dozen of them here. In case you want them, you can obtain it from her. After the meeting is over, we'd be happy to serve you in that respect. The subject we introduced last week, we introduced with this matter of justice and mercy, and you remember that we define justice as rightness, not right doing, but rightness. Now, Webster gives another definition for it by saying correctness, which is very, very close to the same thing. It is being right, not just doing right. Now, mercy we defined as kindness. Justice, the very word justice, implies rightness, and when anyone asks for justice to be done, it implies that he believes that he's right. Correct? If he didn't, he certainly wouldn't be asking for justice, because justice implies that if I'm wrong, justice means that I'm punished. If I'm right, I'm not punished. I mean, this is you can meet it out any way you want, but that's the way it comes out. Now, mercy, on the other hand, implies guilt. When a person asks for mercy, it implies there is guilt. And you throw yourself at the mercy of the judge, the court, or whatever it is, whatever law you have offended, you say, and this is just the areas that we're covering here. Now, love is a perfect blend of these two characteristics, justice and mercy, and as these two blend together, they reveal justice in rightness, and they reveal also mercy in kindness. Now, in the book of Isaiah, in the 59th chapter and verse 14, Isaiah 59 and verse 14, the prophet says, "And judgment is turned away backward, and justice standeth afar off. For truth is fallen in the street, and equity cannot enter." That's a very interesting fact to me, that justice and truth are linked together often in the scriptures, but mercy and truth are also linked together with many, many different references. So you have here that which we are trying to blend together, and when you blend these two together, you have the true manifestation of divine love. I suppose that there's no place that one can understand this as much as in the area of God's dealing with our first parent. This is where justice and mercy found their most difficult area to be really entered into. For our first parents had sinned, and justice demanded what? Death. But God's mercy, God's love, wanted to avert this death, and so very delicately, God could not set aside the just law that had been broken. That was impossible. So very delicately, yet positively, he had to actually make a way to satisfy the law that had been broken, and at the same time accomplish the act of kindness or mercy that he had toward those who had broken the law. So while his heart reached out, you see, to Adam and Eve in their sinful condition, his mercy could not abrogate, set aside the law. It had to meet both, and in this we find the manifestation of his love. The Bible gives a number of different experiences that help us to understand this, but I suppose that the parable that of the unjust judge is about as descriptive and as can be on this. And I'm going to read to you something this evening. It's not going to take but just a couple of minutes, but I'm going to read to you something on this, and then we're going to get into something that I hope will be an exchange. In Christ Object Lessons on page 164, these words, Christ had been speaking of the period just before his second coming. When does that? That's now. And of the perils through which his followers must pass. With special reference to that time, he related the parable to this end, that men ought always to pray and not to faint. Then he gave the parable. There was in a city, he said, a judge, which feared not God, neither regarded man. There was a widow in that city, and she came unto him, saying, Avenge me of mine adversary. And he would not for a while. But afterward he said within himself, Though I fear not God, nor regard man, yet because the widow troubleth me, I will avenge her, lest by her continual coming she weary me. And the Lord said, Hear what the unjust judge saith. And shall not God avenge his own elect, which cry day and night unto him, though he bear long with them? I tell you that he will avenge them speedily. Now, I'm going to attempt something, stopping right there. I'm going to attempt to make a paraphrase of this, and I may get my tongue twisted. But I'll try not to. So you bear with me as I do this. This isn't funny. Okay. All right. There was in a city a parent which feared not God, neither regarded man. And to this parent was born a little girl. And she came to her parents when she had grown a little older, saying, I want to go play. And the parent would not let her for a while. But afterward, she said within herself, though I fear not God, nor regard man, but because my little girl troubleth me, I will avenge her, lest her continual pestering me weary me. And the parent said, and the Lord said, hear what this unjust parent said. Shall not God avenge his own, which cried day and night unto him, though he bear long with them? I tell you, he will avenge them speedily. I would like to suggest that we spend the first part of our meeting this evening taking this word justice and discussing it freely and openly in the context of a few, possibly only one or two words that have direct bearing on the subject. And I want your participation very, very freely tonight. And I'm glad you came, Gary. I want to see you after the meeting.
Come back.
I need some information that you have. Okay. Honey, why don't you get around there and grab that piece of chalk and write...
Where's the chalk?
Up there, on there, by the eraser.
All right.
Write honesty. Thank you. All right. Now, in the context... You may sit, Mother. In the context of justice, let's think about this word honesty as it relates to parents dealing with children. How does it relate? How does it relate? Can you think of ways and means that honesty have a direct bearing on justice? How long or how old was your child when you first heard him or her say, it ain't fair? Maybe they said it to somebody that they were playing with, or to sister, or to you. But that isn't fair. Have you heard anyone say? It's very, very, very young when a child begins to put together a sense of justice at a very early age. Now, it may be correct, or it may be incorrect, but honesty has a great bearing upon the subject. It has a tremendous bearing on the subject. I'd like to have you think with me just a little bit this evening on this particular subject, and I'd like to have you come up with some kind of ideas on it. How could it possibly relate to justice? Then, if this is... How could you be just and not be honest? This is very, very true. A child relates justice to this matter of... Well, let's go back. Let's pick up. Now, first of all, justice, the word justice probably throws us a little bit, because I would like to have you forget the word justice and think of the definition. What is the definition?
Rightness.
The definition is rightness. All right. Now then, in the light of rightness, honesty has a tremendous bearing, you say, because if a child sees dishonest practices in a parent, dishonesty in any way, this then reflects on their evaluation of your justice toward them. Correct? Do you believe this? Now then, I'd like to have us think in just a few minutes of time here. How can we give, or how do we give, impressions of dishonesty to our children?
By telling them why they can, like we have rules, you mustn't eat before you go to bed at night. But if they happen to see Mama sneak something into her mouth, when right after they've been told not to eat anything before they go to bed, then what kind of an idea of rightness are we giving her? About what kind of an idea of honesty are we giving? Or is it okay for Mama and not as wrong for child?
This is one way. That's very true. Example. The example of actually a regulation, and again, justice very often relates to regulations or rules. And somebody said last week and put in a question, what kind of rules should we have? Remember that we stated at the very beginning last week that we should have few rules, but they should be well thought out, and rules that you can justify. You can back up. I was in a home Friday, not too very far from here, but it wasn't in one of your homes. And I walked in the home. The mother had two children. One of them was probably 8, 9, a boy, and a girl probably 12, 13. I don't think I was in that home more than 20 minutes. During the time I was there, I think she gave about 47 rules. And about 3 spankings and a couple of cuffs besides. And she sent the girl to her room 4 or 5 times. And she told the boy to stay out of the crib 6 times. And the boy was in the crib. And the girl never went to the room. And I was in confusion. Total confusion. I'd like to have told her some things. Might have helped, might have not. But anyway, this sort of thing.
Now, I've got a little gem on this very thing you asked about honesty.
Okay.
Can I do it?
Yes.
May I do it?
Gem it.
Okay. About being honest and how do we teach dishonesty. And this is written by Miriam Wood, you know, who writes the When You're Young. And
she writes some good ones.
I love her. This is written 10 years ago, so it's, you know, of course she was...
Probably young. Better then than it was.
Yeah.
Now.
But anyway, this woman is a 6th grade school teacher at a public school, and she was giving directions to the children, and she starts and tells them a little story, and then they're to finish, and here's the way it goes. I'm going to give you the beginning of a story, and you may write an ending for it, any sort of ending that you wish it to have. You may make it long or short, good or bad, it's all up to you. A rustle of anticipation stirred through the class, since these were bright, creative children who loved nothing better than to express themselves. As the papers were passed down each row, 32 pairs of eyes focused intently on the paragraph that was to begin the story. This is the paragraph. George and Bob had gone downtown together on a hot summer afternoon. Before long, they had both spent all their money except for bus fare home and were looking around for something to do. Suddenly, George exclaimed, "Say, that new theater has awfully good air conditioning. I'm sure we can slip in without paying. Let me tell you how." And as the 6th graders read their mind, then they're going ahead and writing their stuff. And so, At the prearranged time signal, Miss Winfield asked those to stand who wished to read their stories aloud. About a dozen boys and girls were eager to share their work with their classmates. And so on, so on. Anyway, now she tells how they were read. As the stories were read and discussed, Miss Winfield subtly guided the children's minds toward the point that while one may get away with it, does it make one a happier person, so on. So finally, Leonard raised his hand. Miss Winfield, what you say is probably all right, but when I was a little kid and my big brother wanted to go places, my mother always made him take me along so she could have some peace and quiet. After he was 12, that's when you always have to pay adult prices for everything, you know. She told him to keep saying he was under 12. And one day we went somewhere, I've forgotten the details, and the manager made us come into his office. He said he had seen us around the neighborhood for so many years, he knew my brother just had to be at least 12. My brother wouldn't admit that he was because he was afraid of what my mother would do. He just lied and said he was under 12. Finally, the manager said if he would just admit it, he wouldn't do anything about it. So my brother admitted it. But when my mother found out about it, she was furious. Now hands were sprouting all over the room like little plants. Mark was next. Being somewhat of a philosopher, he began his comment this way. When I was a little kid, I was awfully honest. I think I'm getting to be a crook now, though. Anyway, when I was little, my father used to take me to ball games with him. The man taking the tickets said that any child under 5 years old could duck under the turnstile and didn't have to pay. After I got to be 7 or 8, my dad kept trying to get me to duck under and just pretend I was still 5, as if the man was so stupid he couldn't tell the difference between a 5-year-old and an 8-year-old. I wouldn't do it. I would have been so embarrassed if the man had said anything, I'd rather not have gone to the ball game. The children in Miss Winfield's class, in an ingenious manner, the very young, were not aware that they were revealing some family secrets that parents undoubtedly would have given a great deal to have kept hidden. let's see now, anyway. Teaching, of course, because all parents are teaching all the time. Not formally, to be sure, except in certain instances, but by the much more powerful techniques of suggestion, persuasion, and example, and so on. Anyway, I'm not going to read all of it, but that's a little example of dishonesty. By the way, would somebody by the thermostat back there turn it down about 5 degrees? I think we're all going to just roast if we keep it this warm.
Great. All right. Say, by the way, right now, we were waiting until everyone got here so that we could... wait a minute, let me put some in. We could take up the offering. This offering is to pay our babysitters, and really, it costs us about $10 each night here, so we'd appreciate what you can do to help out in this. The areas that I'd like to see us just touch on, and Chuck, you had your hand up a moment ago.
Well, what you read is kind of covering what I was going
to
say.
Oh, okay. All right. Now, let's think of areas that are sensitive areas. Let's think of the telephone. I suppose more lies have been told over telephones than any other method, any other means, media. In the country, boys and girls are very quick to pick up dishonesty in telephone conversations. It's quite often that a boy or girl listening will hear parents express themselves about their dislike for someone. Maybe even irritation. And the telephone rings, and my, of all things, it's that very person. Well, hello. I'm so glad to hear from you. My, what are you doing anyway? You know, and we go on with the most loving conversation, and Junior sits there, and what do you suppose is going on in his mind?
What are you supposed to say? Well, I guess you don't have to say you're glad to hear from him if you're not.
You should have never said the bad thing.
The point is, you're saying... I am glad that you said that, Susie, because that's exactly what we wanted. You see, here's the point. If actually boys and girls hear negativeness, criticism...
Stories and stories about people.
I know you.
So don't get started.
But if they hear this, and then you actually reverse yourself. Like when you have some caller who comes to your home regularly, and you simply say, "My, I just get so tired of them coming," and then open the door and say, "My, come on in, I'm so glad to see you." Because you wouldn't do that, I mean, none of you. Nevertheless, Junior sees this, he knows your feeling, because you've expressed it, in the quietness, in the, maybe even confusion, of your own home. But the privacy of your own home, you've expressed this, and you've been honest with the way you really feel. But when you go to the door, are you honest? Are we honest? Do we actually reveal that which we have said? Now, the facts are that we should, if we have these feelings, we should never, ever express them. Because if we do, Junior is going to say, when you mete out your rules, your admonition, your counsel, he's going to say, "I don't know whether to believe this or not. I really don't know whether to believe it or not." Because he does not believe in this kind of thing. He has, in his mind, has to be trained to think dishonestly. Because naturally, a child, until he is warped and twisted in his thinking, until Satan does the work that actually you don't want him to do, and believe me, if you do not train him to appreciate honesty and uprightness, there's somebody who will train him to believe dishonesty and to appreciate dishonesty. But what do you think about this matter of just exaggeration? What, how does this affect you? Or do you ever exaggerate? I've told you a million times not to do that.
More or less.
My favorite one is all 12 of you get in the other room.
It probably seems like 12, doesn't it, sometimes?
Exaggeration. Do you think that it has an important factor? Do you think it has an important bearing?
Yes.
Yes? Why?
I thought
you were the same thing. They don't know just how far you mean, really mean. What's reality, really?
This is just the point. A child cannot distinguish between degrees. To a child, you say, dishonesty, exaggeration is dishonest. That's all. If you say to the child, well, yeah, or to somebody on the telephone, "Well, man, I got up at 5 o'clock this morning." And in reality, you didn't get up until 6:30. But it felt like you got up at 5 o'clock in the morning.
You're a liar. Gary's got to speak.
Okay, what about reading Little Red Riding Hood in this time?
Amen. You couldn't
I think Little Red Riding Hood has been read all it needs to be read.
Yeah. In other words, fantasy and untruth, really. And
it has no place whatsoever in a child's vocabulary or in a child's mental development. In reality. Are we talking about blanks? Are we pulling blanks?
How about imagination?
Imagination. All right.
Sanctified imagination is good.
Imagination. The imagination should definitely be cultivated. Very definitely. But how?
This is what bring out some things that you might think. Forgive me. When I was teaching, I used to do like the fifth grade teacher, and my kids loved it. So the first and second and third graders, but they loved it. They loved stories and you get all sorts of funny things. We had a school newspaper, and I told them one of the first graders' stories to publish. The principal didn't think it was very good. I thought it was great. It shows that we had different ideas about imagination. Her story was about popping corn, a little man that popped out of the popcorn. Well, obviously it didn't happen, and she knew it didn't happen. I mean,
there's no nothing wrong with that, I don't think. I mean, to me, it seems like this kind of imagination, you say to the children, this is a play story. This is a pretend thing we're doing. And at least that's
it's
how...
It's a story.
Pardon?
It's completely different from when little boy wrote about it. It's highway crime because the cars are sort of rolled up there. I mean, they made their own story.
Probably does hurt.
Susan? Yeah.
Well, and back to what we were talking about, the fairy tales. We've never read them in our house, but one time we were in a place where we had to wait and wait, and the children were restless, and the only book they had was Hansel and Gretel. So I read it to the children, and I thought, well, I'll just explain this. It's pretend. Now, I couldn't believe how strongly it affected them, because they weren't used to that kind of thing. And for 2 or 3 days, or even longer, they pretended they were pushing each other into the oven like the old witch did. I was really sorry I ever touched it, because it does affect me, even just one little story, one time.
Jackie,
that's
amazing.
Correct. Jackie?
Well, I have a question on the line, too. I don't know. To me, the problem is more how much frivolity do we allow in our lives, and how much should we allow? And that's something that I've had to learn recently, because imagination... Despite the fact that a child knows it's pretend, that I don't think it's a real problem. Maybe in some cases it is. Children I've dealt with it hasn't been a problem. I knew it was imagination, it was pretend, and it wasn't real. But it's still frivolous. It's still...
Correct.
To me, that's the root of the problem, and I'd like to just move on from that, because this is a frivolity in our lives. One of the things...
Mrs. White uses the term sanctified imagination on a number of different occasions. And I think that it is self-explanatory. Sanctified imagination would leave no room for frivolity in the imagination.
Define frivolity.
Pardon? Define frivolity, then. All right. Define frivolity.
In terms of what we're talking about here, in other words, the question at hand here now, is it frivolous? Are we encouraging frivolity when we allow children to, for instance, like Wanda was saying there, to write these stories of imaginative type of thing? Is this encouraging frivolity, or is it frivolity? Isn't that what you're thinking of, Jackie?
I think to write imaginative stories that can be real would be something you would encourage and would come under the category of sanctified imagination or controlled imagination. But to actually let the imagination run wild is an entirely different thing.
Of course, in a case like with Rhonda there, now, here she is a teacher, tells the children, you have this opportunity, 10 minutes to write a story. Since she isn't controlling the children's minds and is not planting seeds in their minds of what they shall write, the children are going to write out of their background. Children who have had a lot of artificial imagination, are likely to write something along that line. Children who have had more natural, natural training would write something more possible.
All right. Chuck?
It seems to me like even with the children that have had a frivolous background, that if you would just ask them as they write their story to try and make it something that they know could really happen. And you wouldn't be telling them what to write about, but you might direct their imagination in the right direction.
All right. Let me just now read to you a little counsel from the Lord. And this is taken from page 152 and 3. Of child guidance, and it has to do with this word honesty, because this is the thing that we're trying to zero in on tonight, to be perfectly honest. And how important is it? It is essential that honesty be practiced in all the details of a mother's life. I don't know why she zeroed in on mothers here, but this is true. And it is important in the training of children to teach the youthful girls, as well as boys, never to prevaricate or to deceive in the least. Now, imagination run wild is certainly in prevarication in its generally in its more revealed sense. It's nature. We can certainly see it there. Prevarication is exaggeration. It is this type of thing that we just got through talking about a moment ago. God wants men in his service under his banner to be strictly honest, unimpeachable in character, that their tongues shall not utter a semblance of untruth. What does this do then with exaggeration, prevarication, any of these things? The tongue must be true, the eyes must be true, the actions holy and entirely such as God can command. We're living in the sight of a holy God who solemnly declares, I know thy works. The divine eye is ever upon us. We cannot cover one act of unjust deal from God. The witness of God to our every action is a truth which but few realize. Deceit and falsehood and unfaithfulness may be glossed over and hidden from the eyes of man, but not from the eyes of God. The angels of God who watch the development of character in children and weigh moral worth regard in the books of heaven these minor transactions which reveal character. I have just another thought here to bring on this, because I think that there are areas that we could discuss here for hours that would be very profitable. Honesty with time as well as money. Men are wanted whose sense of justice, even in the smallest matters, will not allow them to make an entry of their time that is not minute and correct. Men who will realize that they are handling means that belong to God and who would not unjustly appropriate one cent of their own for their own use. Men who will be just as faithful and exact, careful and diligent in their labor, in their absence of their employer as in his presence, proving by their faithfulness that they are not merely men pleasers, eye servants, but are conscientious, faithful, true workmen, doing right, not for human praise, but because they love and choose the right from a high sense of their obligation to God. Let me ask you something in this respect. How many times have you said, well, I'd like to do this, but I just don't have time, and then sit down in front of Junior and doze off to sleep? Or do something else that absolutely reveals to Junior that this is only what?
Excuse.
An excuse. Are your excuses and are mine always honest? Does that hit home?
Mm.
Are they always honest? Most of the time we pick the one that we actually think will really, you know, get the person off your back. Whatever it is. We simply pick that excuse and we make the excuse and we go on. I'd sure like to help you, but I just don't have time. I can't work it into my schedule today. First place, you don't even have a schedule, possibly. And the second place, you didn't really want to. You wanted not to. And you were looking for an excuse not to do the thing, whatever it was. I think that when Junior hears us do this, it's a very difficult thing for him to discern where honesty really comes in here. Now, this is a big subject. You see, we're told here that a person who is perfectly honest never schemes. You know what that is? Never schemes. He never takes advantage of his neighbor. And who is my neighbor? And so forth. He is a friend and a benefactor to all, and his fellow men put confidence in his counsel. A truly honest man will never take advantage of weakness and incompetency in order to benefit himself. Well, I would like to hear anything more on this before we close. Yes, Pam.
Well, it seems to me that we make the children wrong. When I took care of the kids, I knew this little boy was a firebug. I knew it. And he said that, well, that one summer, he was about 12 years of fire. I'd always ask him, did you do that? And actually, he'd always say no. And I knew he'd say no. And so someone told me that I wasn't reading the right book and gave me a book to read. And this author brought out that we should never put any child in a position to make him wrong.
In other words, don't tempt a child. Correct.
That really confused me. But then I got to think about it. We do make our children wrong.
We create the atmosphere, Janet.
Well,
very
often. We punish them in such a way that they're afraid
to tell
the truth. Well, this is true. This is true.
Like I said, if you did that, I'm going to thank you.
Well, so I'm not going to tell you the truth.
See, my wife is reacting just exactly.
Marion has a hand up.
Marion?
Well, I had a thought on this. This was my own thought before I read this, and somebody else seems to think the same way that I do on it. I was brought up the same way, and I lied to my teeth for years. It just became a way of life, simply to avoid, I wanted to do what I wanted to do, and I was going to do it anyway. And so I lied, because I knew what would happen if I told the truth. That I have a real strong feeling about this, and I have a thing with my little girl that if I know if something is really bad, if something was to happen that she knows I would be really upset about, and so I say, and but she's painfully honest, that if I see that there might be a, what do I do? I say, if you're afraid to tell me, if you're afraid I'm going to punish, I won't punish you if you tell me. And I don't. Mm-hmm. And I don't think it's necessary because she is so hurt to have hurt me that I don't think, in some instances, that punishment is necessary.
Mm-hmm.
And this was brought out in this book, Journal of a Happy Woman. And I think it was her carpenter or her plumber that told her that she was just really chastising her little boy for something, and he wasn't giving any answers. And so he told her after the little boy was out of earshot that they were stealing him, that's what he said. They had a ruling in their home that now, maybe it's not the right thing to do,
no,
but
I'm
inclined to think it is, because I think it's awful to frighten your children by punishing them.
This gets the justice and the mercy straightened out.
This is where justice and mercy come together, and this is the point that we want to bring out here as we're being.
I mean, I'm not all that concerned about punishment because I'm going to forget about it.
There.
I'm going to forget what
I disagree in a little way, I really do. Because if you don't punish a child in some respect, I mean, you don't have to beat them.
Mm-hmm.
But then that would encourage them to do it again. I mean, what's to lose? All they have to do is say, yep, I did it, and go do it again.
I don't think
right.
So.
I don't have it look that way, though.
All right.
Jackie.
That's Jackie?
But if fear is the only motive for anything, it's no motive at all.
Oh, that's the point. That's the point. Now, getting back to love, my wife is pushing me here because she wants to get into these questions, and I do too. But
I haven't even touched you.
No, I know.
Well,
I'm motivated by fear now. So.
Yeah.
But anyway, I believe very definitely that here is where you see the blending of justice and mercy in love. And I can point you tonight to a lady that is highly respected in this area, extremely highly respected, who has told me that the most difficult problem that she has to face in her Christian life is to tell the truth. Now, I think if we're perfectly honest, all of us, we'll find and we will admit that this is probably one of the most difficult habits of life to break. Not rank out and out lies, but just colored, just twisted truths to make them untruths. Just enough, actually, that really gets us by. Maybe just exaggerations or prevarications or whatever it might be. But this is one thing that we need to watch very, very carefully in childbearing. Because, like Janet suggests here, we very, very often promote falsehood in our children. We create the atmosphere, and then actually tempt the child to lie, and then punish them for doing that which we tempted them to do. Now, I believe this is a very, very sad situation, and I think that we need to be very careful in dealing with it.
Does this enter into this text, provoke not your children to wrath? I think it does.
I think it could have a very definite bearing, because, you see, the very answer that the child might give, he has heard mother and dad give in a similar situation, and it got them off the hook, but it doesn't get Junior off the hook, you see. When Junior does the very thing that he's seen mother and dad do, he gets whipped for it. But mother and dad didn't get a thing for it. Not a thing.
I agree with Gary to a certain extent, because I think that children shouldn't, and I know this isn't what marrying means. I know marrying well enough. I know she doesn't mean that when her child does something bad, she doesn't force her to tell the truth and she never gets any discipline about it. But there's ways of handling this. When some children's temperaments are such that they really don't want to grieve their mother or their father, and therefore if they have, in the predicament like Miriam is speaking of here, after you have gotten them to tell you the truth and you haven't given them physical punishment or even a bad scolding, but to just sit down and explain, some children respond to this and they don't want to hurt you again. I know our son was this way when he was a little boy. Nothing made him feel worse than to make me sad. Which I was really fortunate to have that kind of little boy. He didn't want to make me sad. And I didn't have to whale him and, you know, do a lot of the things that, because he wanted to be good.
That's, he took after his dad.
Yes.
Now, let's approach this. Now, just taking this one matter of honesty and lying as a great manifestation of this, and the lying can be in
dishonesty.
You know, in any area, and it's still dishonesty. Now, what is the greatest prevention for this? What is the greatest prevention for this?
For the parents or the children?
To prevent this developing in my children.
Oh, be honest.
All right, now.
Be honest with myself.
Right. To be honest with myself, there's something more than that.
Be honest with God.
Yes, there's. This is absolutely true.
All right, what do you have up your sleeve?
All right. The thing that we need to do is to absolutely build confidence in our children. Let them know you believe in them.
Amen.
Let them know that you believe that they are honest, they want to be honest, and if they disappoint you, then let them know that this has grieved you because it grieves God. This is the greatest bulwark against actual lying. It's the greatest bulwark against any kind of deception of any kind. We, I suppose, have been, I think, blessed above all parents in this, many parents in this kind of thing, because this doesn't only work with a little child, but it works with teenagers, it works with young adults. And both of our children, oh my, you won't even let me say it. But both of our children have testified, as they have grown up and established homes of their own, they said, we just simply couldn't do many things that other kids did because we knew that you trusted us, and we simply couldn't, we just couldn't break that trust. And this is just so absolutely essential. If you suspect your child, if you act as though you are suspicioning, if you condemn, if you accuse, you are going to promote this in that child every time. They will do what you tell them to do. Johnny, you are a naughty boy. Johnny will be a naughty boy. This is absolutely true. Build confidence and demonstrate that you have confidence in them right from the time that they're a little tiny child. You say, Johnny, I want you to put your toys away. And you leave it at that and don't say it 10 times. And when you come back in the room 3 minutes later and the toys are not away, you express disappointment, definite disappointment, because you were depending upon him to do this. And you let them know that this grieves you, because it grieves God to have him disappoint you. Grieves God. And a child begins to put this whole thing together in their mind, and it's, you must start when they're young to do this thing. Denise?
How do you feel when a child does disappoint you and a punishment is in order, letting the child choose his own discipline? By sitting down and explaining to them what has been done and that a punishment is necessary, and do you feel that a child should be able to choose his own discipline within reason? I know my aunt and uncle used to sit down and take their children into a room and talk to them, and they didn't always get spanked, but they would always have to choose some form of punishment that was suitable between my aunt and uncle and their child, whatever they did.
I think that decisions that a child is allowed to make must be a graduated experience according to their ability, their age. Never allow a child to make a decision that is beyond his ability to make. But there are benefits in this type of thing. But the choice must be between, say, two punishments, if you're going to use a choice factor in this area. But for a child to say, "Well, I'll do this or that or something else," to come up with his own, he's not capable of doing a thing like this, and neither does it mete out justice. Justice and mercy must both be met. Mercy can be given in this, can be shown in this kind of a thing, but justice must also be met, always. If justice isn't met, mercy then is not understood. Chuck?
I was going to say that if we follow this counsel on the depending on the child to do the right thing, we would eliminate many of the rules that we now feel are necessary.
Correct.
It wouldn't be necessary.
And the thing that really is so important in this is that when you tell a child to do something, make sure that they understand it, and then don't just repeat it.
You know, a lot of this is going to be covered in these questions when we actually get into these questions.
Some of our time now is going to be turned over to Mrs. Phillips.
Oh no, not to me, but I'm going to read the
question. What we decided to do, folks, is this. We're going to take some aspects that are not directly tied with the questions or the suggestions that you made, and we had a large number of real fine suggestions, but we're going to take some aspects of justice and mercy each night and see how we can blend these together in a very positive way and come up with something that is really beneficial. And then we're going to try and go into these questions. We want your suggestions. We want your discussion in these. Okay.